chickens in the houses, they got chickens in the trees, chicken in the pots, the Mottawok, the Petaloomies, out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Now Marvin got me started, sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20, and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? In the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken, Petaluma never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
My guest this evening must be our very own chef, John Ash, who has a brand new book, Culinary Birds, The Ultimate Poultry Cookbook. Welcome back to Mouthful.
Thanks.
It's so great to have you here. But not all that long. You were on about 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah. What did we talk about then?
Oh, gosh. You were here with someone else. Maybe Steve Garner.
Oh, that's right. I think.
And we were talking about the food contest.
Yeah.
Are you going to
have
one this year?
We are. We're not quite sure what it is or when it's going to be, but we'll definitely have another recipe contest.
Yes. You know what
I'm hoping
it is.
No, I think we do know because. Can I mention this?
Yes.
Because it's your.
It is going to be.
You actually were
awesome.
the person who helped us do that.
So it's going to be meatballs.
Meatballs.
Yeah, and the winner. The winner gets to have a recipe in my new meatball book.
So when? So what's the cutoff date for that, for the meatball book?
I have to turn the book in April, in March.
Oh, that's fine.
The end of March.
So we'll have the contest before then. Yeah.
March 29th.
You
have to have the contest.
So can I tell you something about meatballs? I'm dying to try it. David Rosengarten, who you know, who is a kind of famous New York personality, has a blog that he writes on. And I got this thing. Actually, it was in the last month or two, and he said the best meatball that he's ever had in his life was one in which he ground up big chunks of mortadella in it. Doesn't that sound good? I don't know whether it's good or not, but it sounds great.
Wow. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Big chunks of mortadella.
Yeah, doesn't that sound great? So you have to go home and try that.
I love mortadella.
I do, too.
It's really love mortadella.
On anything.
Yes.
In anything would be fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. I just got another recipe for
the
book.
It is. And that's right. And so we're going to announce it. We haven't even announced it on KSRO.
Uh-huh.
It's the meatball contest.
Great.
And all.
Well, people are really passionate about meatballs. They're passionate about their grandmother's meatballs.
Yeah.
They're passionate about the meatballs at their favorite restaurant.
Yeah. And it's not just Mediterranean Italian meatballs, but the Asians do amazing meatballs made out of... North African, out of all kinds of things that we don't even think about.
So it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun. So Culinary Birds.
Yeah. Isn't that a terrible title?
I didn't think that until you said it. You thought it was a terrible title.
I should say that. So I'll tell you a little story. People would ask me, oh, you're working on a new book, any new books? And I said, yeah, I'm working on this book. And they said, well, what's it called? And I said, Culinary Birds. And they would kind of look at me like, now, what is that?
But they didn't quite get it? Is that it?
Yeah. So the subtitle to this is the ultimate poultry cookbook.
I just love birds so much that to hear the word bird is fine with me.
Well, but I think it conjures up something else. It's like, oh, you're not eating birds, are you?
Oh, no. Well, of course we are. There's no ravens in here,
no,
are they?
No, robins or finches or those kinds of...
We have quite a history of Sonoma County and of raven. I mean, of robins, you know.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to get Gayla Baron on to talk about that.
Yeah.
The finding of the robin traps when the Prohibition police...
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, it's in... I think it's in Gayla Baron's book, Santa Rosa, a 20th Century Town. And there was a restaurant out in East Santa Rosa, for sure. I don't know if it was all the way to Kenwood. But, you know, they would come in every now and then and bust, you know, the red wine that people were getting in their juice glasses. Uh-huh. And in more than one restaurant, they found robin traps.
You're kidding.
And Joe and Wally, I had the extreme pleasure of interviewing Joe and Wally a number of years ago, and he talked about how, you know, he's on West Side Road, first guy to plant Pinot Noir, and there in the creeks around there, they would put up little mist nets to catch robins, and they would make that classic Italian dish, which was songbirds over polenta.
Yeah,
here they had robins because they didn't have what they were used to.
Yikes.
So, yeah. So,
I don't think, have you ever eaten a robin?
No, I have not ever eaten a robin. I've never eaten, to my knowledge, I've never eaten a songbird.
A little songbird. So there was that great story, and actually the publisher wanted me to include it just as a little comment about mitron. You know,
eating
the little tiny larks, and they eat them bones and all. And I said, no, that's just too gross for Americans.
And you know, there was that story about that on This American Life.
Yeah.
And I had the woman chef, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to think of her name right now. You probably met her when she was here. She'd been chef.
Yeah.
To Mitterrand.
Yeah.
I asked her about that story, and she told me I had asked the wrong question. It was none of my business, and that the story that was on This American Life was an intrusion, and we should not talk about it. It's like, okay, I will not say another word.
Well, because I think it's a kind of private moment, because he was dying, and this was kind of his last meal.
Did this guy get to go? Or was the guy on This American Life, was he there?
I don't think so.
Okay, so he just managed to...
To get the story.
Yeah, because I think it was the last meal.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
And I thought it was a very tender story.
Well, and it is, and there's a whole ritual that we shouldn't talk about that, but this whole ritual
of the napkin over your head
and you put the bird up under the napkin so that, you know, people can't see you.
And I didn't know it was a lark.
It was a finch or a lark or one of, but tiny little birds.
Because, I got my very first puppy ever, and she's the color.
I thought you were a cat lady.
I am. I've crossed over to the dark side, but I still have cats. But I got my first puppy, and she's the color of a meadow lark, and she's very tiny, and I named her Lark.
Oh, that's great.
So it's eating larks. Anyway, you have this fabulous new book.
Yes.
That is going to cause me a lot of trouble in my life, John.
Why?
I have to take you to task.
Why?
I'm terrified that I'm not going to be able to get chicken feet anymore.
Oh, well.
I've been warning people, because I've been buying chicken feet and duck feet for years at farmers markets.
Yeah.
And I've been telling them, it's like, okay, you guys, John is talking about this.
Yeah.
You are going to have a run on chicken feet.
I hope so, because it's one of those things, I think most of us don't think about it, but you know, every chicken has 2 feet, every duck has 2 feet. Where do they all go? What happens to them? In typical supermarkets, we never see them. But if you go to Asian and Mexican markets, of course, they're there.
And French markets that you'll get from beak to toenail.
Yeah. And they're turned into the most wonderful dishes, you know, braise for a long, long time and eat them as is. But they make the most extraordinary stock, you know, and that's kind of how that's their great contribution to food. And, you know, think of all the chickens that are raised around here in Sonoma County and all that.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of it just the commodity chicken, the chicken from the big companies.
Yeah.
I guess they're just sold off for... Pet food?
Sometimes pet food, but they actually go to the Asian and Mexican communities. So they use them a lot. And it's sort of like other you know, what used to be cheap, you know, it's actually chicken feet are now kind of becoming more expensive. It's kind of like chicken wings used to be cheap, you know.
Well, remember when you could get lamb shanks for like $1.99 and now what are they, $14.99?
Yeah, because it's very shishi food.
Yeah, and lamb's tongue, the same thing with lamb's tongue.
So it could be that chicken feet will be the next
here we go.
Little thing. Well, and wings are one of those that are, you know, they would almost give you wings, you know, from chickens, and now they're more expensive than chicken, than a whole chicken.
So why chicken? Why a book on poultry?
You know, that's a darn good question, Michelle. That's a really good question. It actually wasn't a book that I thought about doing. So the guy whose name is also on the bottom of the book brought me the project, and he said, you know, I have some interest from publishers. They want to do a kind of book surveying contemporary methods of cooking poultry and all this stuff. So it's not a book just about chicken, but it's about duck and goose and quail and all of that stuff. Would you like to do it? And I thought, oh, sure. You know, and part of it is, I mean, I'm a big, I love poultry of all kinds. But I thought, I'm sure you must find the same thing with your books. It forces you to kind of dive in more deeply and learn more things.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's a great opportunity to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you covered, I mean, you went from, I mean, the book of the books, chicken, and of course, and I'm so thrilled, there's a chapter on eggs, which there should be.
Which came first.
Yes, in this case, the chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
The egg chapter is later.
Yeah.
But you also have, let's see if I can get everything, turkey, duck, goose, quail, squab, guinea hen. I'm forgetting one. Guinea hen, it's in the chat. Pheasant?
Pheasant, yeah.
Pheasant and one more, I think.
A couple of pheasant recipes.
Yeah.
And actually, you even included a little ostrich recipe in
there. Oh, you did?
Yeah. Remember when it was...
It was big, like 12 years ago.
Yeah.
What happened to the ostrich producers
here? I don't know. An emu and ostrich. Remember, we were all supposed to buy a mating pair, and it would be the new beef. And
there were two producers in Sonoma Valley.
Yeah.
They were selling at farmers markets.
Yeah, and I guess they're all gone now.
Yeah. You know, I guess it didn't take off.
I don't. It's,
there
it's
was something about
it's
it.
It's like mink.
Yeah, really. Like, yeah. Well, I bought a lot of ostrich. I have, I think, four recipes in a new cook's tour of Sonoma. I made ostrich meatloaf, burgers, and then all of a sudden, wow, I've eaten my lifetime fill. I don't ever want it again.
But it's good. You know?
It's good, but something became cloying about it.
So I have to say that thank you for doing that. I have one of Michelle's recipes in the book.
Well, thank you for having it.
Yeah,
it was fun. It was fun to see it there. You called me colorful. Thank you.
Well, that's a good description of you, isn't it?
Probably it is. So let's go back to the chicken feet, because the most, you know, after salt, really, one of the most basic things to have in your kitchen is not canned chicken stock, if you can avoid it, but homemade chicken stock. It's easy to do. So talk a little bit more about that.
Well, there, you know, the whole idea of stock, you know, stock leading to soup, and I know you know this, but I love, in various parts of the world, they talk about stock, a basic stock being, you know, it's kind of the elixir of life.
You like strong stock in China.
Yeah, and it's not even, you know, and it's this whole idea of the eternal stock. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of people who, a lot of cultures in which there is always a pot on the stove and it's always going and it's always replenished and new things go into it, but it's always there just simmering. And the whole idea is that you can go and take that stock and make soups or sauces or whatever you're going to do.
Drink it.
But it never stops.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that we have as a tool, it gets kind of dissed sometimes among serious cooks, is the crock pot, you know, and you can have a crock pot going all of the time, you know, with the fragrance of the bird going into the house, and then you always have something, and I swear to you, it is the secret to losing weight in America. If you just had a flavorful warm stock on the stove always, go take a cup of that, and it'll take the place of the Oreos that you're about to eat.
Oh, interesting. You know, interesting.
Because it's filling and it's warm and it
tastes really good. It's really good for you.
Yeah.
You get, when you're cooking it for that long, you get all the minerals.
Yeah.
I've read, and I wonder if you ascribe to this. If you add a very small amount, not so much that you taste it, maybe a tablespoon of vinegar, it helps withdrawing the minerals out of the bones. So you're getting all of these really incredible nutrients. They're advocates, sort of the young Back to the Earth movement. They think that you should allow a quart of, they call it bone broth, a quart of bone broth per person in the family per day. Which is kind of a lot.
Well, it is, but if it tastes good, it's like, why not? You know, it's kind of a delicious thing. One of the interesting things to me, and what I think I talk about in the book a little bit, last year was in Vietnam, and I was so impressed because soup stocks, you know, with things thrown into this, basically a stock with things thrown in it, are eaten from the very first thing in the morning until the very end of night. They're all day long. I mean, they eat other things too, but it is that idea of this healthy broth. And of course, you look at them and they're all skinny and beautiful and all of that
beautiful
kind of stuff.
Beautiful skin. It's one of the things I love about Asia is their wonderful soups for breakfast. I'm not a cereal. Yeah. I'm not a sweet person in the morning. You know, you can take that either way.
Soup. Oh, okay. So I won't be spending the night.
I'm actually really nice. I just don't like to talk.
No, I'm teasing.
But soup, a savory soup for breakfast. Is just such a wonderful way to wake up.
It is.
And, you know, Asia, Malaysia, I haven't been to Vietnam, but I know Vietnamese soups and I love them.
But they all do it. And it's very much part of the culture that it's always it's always there. It's always. And so dig out your crock pot, damn it.
Oh, I have my, you all dig out your crock pot.
Yeah, and if you can score some feet, throw those in there too, because it gives you that lovely, it both gives you flavor, but more importantly, the feet, the chicken feet, especially, give you this mouthfeel.
Structure.
The collagen, you know, that is extracted from it. And so it's like this rich, you know, without fat, you know, which is the thing we all love.
Yeah,
so.
And it's really, really good.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about, maybe we should take a break and come back and talk about the local versus you know, national, because that's in the news a lot.
Well, especially right now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we'll take a little musical interlude here on Mouthful and be right back.
You are listening to an archived Mouthful show from September 28th, 2014, with John Ash as the guest. Again, this is an archived program from September 28th, 2014, Mouthful, with host Michelle Anna Jordan and guest John Ash.
And I can't relax. This Colonel Sanders' job is getting me down. A crazy chicken chasing me all over town. Psycho chicken. A lot, but he's not saying anything. I plucked him once, why pluck him again? The psycho chicken.
Psycho chicken.
listening to an archived Mouthful show from September 28, 2014, with John Ash as the guest. Again, this is an archived program from September 28, 2014, Mouthful, with host Michelle Anna Jordan and guest John Ash.
Yes. The Fools with a Psycho Chicken and Seriously.
So where did you get that?
I've had it
you
forever.
Have the most eclectic music taste.
Yeah, I mean, how could I not have that? It's just too much fun. So we've got Foster Farms in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A number of years ago, we had Tyson and that horrible situation where people died because they were locked into the processing plant. We have all kinds of problems with huge level production.
Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, it's not just with poultry, it's with beef and everything, actually more.
Lettuce.
Yeah, lettuce. And part of the problem is that what's happened in this country is that we've gotten to the place where there are just a few big processors who process huge amounts of poultry, beef, pork, whatever it is. And so if something goes wrong in one of those big poultry, big processing facilities, it isn't just a little local issue. It becomes a big national issue. And to me, and I talk about this in the book, I'm not glad that it happened, but it kind of points to the thing that you talk a lot about because you're such a farm market advocate.
Yeah.
About knowing where your food comes from, getting it locally, getting it, having somebody who understands what the process is. And one of the things I think that happened with the salmonella thing with Foster Farms, which they haven't copped to yet, is that when the birds are harvested, I guess. Is
I heard you say dispatch yesterday, and I thought, is perfect.
The kind way of saying that what they do is they immediately chill them down, but the traditional method was to put them in big
ice water
baths, which is bad for two reasons. Number one, if a bird, and almost all birds now have salmonella on them, what you have is this big salmonella
bathtub soup
that you're putting the birds in. So every bird then is infected with it, which is not a good thing. And the theory is that if you can get them cold, then it slows down the growth of all these microorganisms and stuff. So number one, the thing to look for with poultry that you're buying in the market, especially chicken, is to look for that which is air chilled.
And that's sort of like in the last two or three years, there's Mary's is big,
Mary's
and now
and
Petaluma Poultry, I've noticed, Rocky and Rosie are doing air chilled.
And what that is, they just put it through a big blast. You know, kind of chiller, and so that they're not cross contaminating all of the other birds that are there. But you know, there are lots of issues. Not the least of which is how the chickens are raised. One of the things, and I know you know, but one of the things I ask people when I'm teaching and doing things like that is, well, you know, that fryer that you buy in the market, how old is it? You know, how long has it lived? You know, and the average age of those things is about 12 weeks.
I heard Steve get that right. And I was actually off. I was going to say 16 weeks. They're actually more about 12.
Well, the ones that we buy commercially are that, because they also pump them full of lots of food. So the things that you get at farmers markets and things like that probably are a little older, which is actually a good thing, because they have a chance to develop a little bit more. But not that you need to get weepy about the life of a chicken and all that stuff, but they are, and I think I say this all the time, they are sentient beings.
And why would you want to eat something that had been miserable its whole life?
Yeah,
how I think about it.
Exactly. And I think it's one of those things, it's like the old cliche of you get angry food from an angry chef, and I think the same thing is true about the ingredients.
And I remember, this was a long time ago, you were at your second restaurant, I think, second, maybe third. I don't know if it was where John Ash and Company now is. It might have still been in Montgomery Village, but Rocky came out.
That was John Ash and Company, yeah.
Right. I don't know. Yeah. It was John Ash and Company. I don't know which one.
Yeah, it was the first one.
But Rocky
That's right, you came. Yeah.
Rocky came out.
Yeah, Alan Chansky.
Yes, and the revelation, I remember Nick Topolos, the nephew of the Topoloses at Russian River Vineyard, who was running Melita Station Bed and Breakfast. Yeah. He and I tried Rocky together for the first time. And the thing that was a major revelation was muscle structure. Yes, there was more flavor. But they talk about free range and what does it mean. And on one hand, I think we can get all, like you said on the air yesterday, airy-fairy about it. Mm. Oh, the chickens go outside. But it means something when they... Just like if you sit in a chair for 30 years, you're not going to have muscles. Mm-hmm. If you sit in a little cage, you're not going to have muscles. And that was a complete transformation for me, chicken-wise.
Yeah. Yeah.
That tasting that muscle structure, mm-hmm. I could never go back.
No, and part of it is also this this thing that we just talked about is that if you take that chicken and throw it in a big ice water bath, it's going to absorb
water right.
And you're paying for that water.
Yeah.
And for sure chlorinated.
Yeah.
You know, that's
so that absorbing that water would soften the muscle structure, wouldn't it?
It would absolutely do it. And you know, and it's kind of a silly way of doing things, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of nutty. So I think it is this, and the other mitigating thing with chicken, and the book is not obviously just about chicken, but it's the biggest part of the book because mm-hmm. that's what most people eat, is that we've gotten so used to cheap food. You know,
yes.
You can go to Safeway and buy Foster Farms chicken for 99 cents a pound and all of that stuff. And then you go to the farmer's market and we have a number of good producers locally who raise really delicious poultry, and it's $2.50 a pound, and it's like, oh my
goodness.
$7.99 a pound. Yeah. And it's like, oh, you mean I'm going to have to spend $25-$30 for a chicken? And mm-hmm. it's like, yeah.
How do you tell people who are really budget conscious, mm. how do you get through to them?
Well, I think there are some alternatives, and mm-hmm. I think we're lucky locally that
sure.
we have Petaluma Poultry and Mary's mm-hmm. up in up north, who raise the chickens ethically. They process them in a good way, and all that stuff, and mm-hmm. they're not so expensive. So they're $2-$3 a pound.
You can get a Mary's. I just bought a Mary's for $3 something a pound.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what you go to if money's of concern.
Uh-huh.
But if you've never done it, you know, if you've never bought chickens, they're also, we talk about it with turkeys because Thanksgiving is coming up about heritage breeds and all that stuff. Well, guess what? The same thing exists with chickens.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of the small growers, recognizing that to grow a regular chicken, it doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, the Cochin and Cross, I guess, is the common one.
Yeah, if they... go after some of these because there are hundreds of different breeds of chicken also. Mm-hmm. So we're beginning to see those in the market.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled when I find those because the Cochin Cross, like the, I don't know what we call the ubiquitous white turkey.
What well, it's just called the white broad-breasted turkey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
because we love breasts. You know,
exactly. And the Cochin Cross was bred for these huge breasts. The birds, they get a couple weeks old and they can't walk. But I'm somebody who prefers dark meat.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about the turkeys that we buy, and ultimately it's about flavor, but the other thing is about those turkeys are they can't procreate. You know, they can't.
Oh.
So they're all artificially inseminated and all of this stuff. And I think a rule... We should all raise our right hand right now and take the pledge that we are not going to buy anything that can't procreate.
Yes, I think that that's a good thing to do. If you are what you eat,
think
about that.
Yes, right, for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about the recipes.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, but
there were a lot more, and they kept cutting
me
back.
Oh, there's a lot, and they're diverse. You do a lot of Asia, but there's one that I want to get to right away. I know that we've talked about this before, and you're one of the only people I can talk to about it.
Oh, no.
No, it's okay. Laksa.
Oh, laksa, yeah.
Is this Penang laksa?
Well,
because you do the coconut-based laksa.
Yeah. So laksa is a kind of cooking from Malaysia. It's a dish, and typically it is a flavorful broth with noodles and other things in it. So you could have laksa made with many different things. Mm-hmm. Penang laksa, interesting, is a non-coconut based.
Oh, okay. So
thing if you go to the city of Penang, but there are many different laksa, but the typical one contains coconut milk. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting combination, and there are probably as many different recipes for laksa as there are people who make them. But what's interesting about it, it's thickened with, in that part of the world, with something called candle nuts, which are very similar.
Is that the same thing as betel nut?
It's a little different, but they look like macadamias. So you can use any nut.
They look a little bit like kukui nut as well.
In fact,
I've wondered if they were kukui nuts.
Yeah, and the thing, you can buy candle nuts in this country, but the caution always is that you need to cook them because they can be a little toxic.
Yeah.
You know, give you a little upset stomach. So use some other kind of nut, macadamias, because we love Hawaii and we should support them.
This is a chicken base.
And this is a chicken one, which is a kind of soup stew thing, which rice noodles, and you make the laksa paste. It's like curry paste is really all it is. So lots of lime juice and coconut milk and coriander and garlic and shallots, and grind it all up in your food processor, or even better yet, in the blender. And what I do at home is just make a big old batch of this stuff and keep it in the fridge for a few days, but freeze it.
Yeah, that's what you said. You can freeze it for like 3 months.
Oh, yeah. And then anytime you want to do this. And it also, you can use it as a soup base, but it also makes the most wonderful sauce that I love. So add a little bit of coconut milk and broth to it, and you have this delicious curried coconut sauce that is good on anything. As I say in my cooking classes, it's even good on your beloved late at night. You know, drizzle a little bit of that on them and things will happen.
It's something that hasn't really broken through to the U.S. yet.
I don't know why. It's because it's been around, you know.
I know when I was going to Malaysia for the first time, Malcolm from Gourmet Mushrooms called me and he said, he set me up with somebody to show me around Kuala Lumpur, and he says, tell him he has to take you for laksa.
Yeah, yeah.
So here I was, you know, on the plane 18 hours, and I'd slept for an hour, and this guy calls me, I'll meet you downstairs in half an hour, and we go out for laksa. I could barely see.
Yeah.
But we went out for two kinds of laksa, and it was really great.
Yeah.
And then I've had it in, I can't think of the name of the place in San Francisco. It was the Malaysian restaurant.
Straits
Cafe.
Yeah.
They had a laksa there.
Yeah.
But it's so good. I keep expecting to see it.
It's delicious. It's delicious, I tell you. Maybe we should just keep it a secret, and we'll just make it for ourselves.
There we go.
Yeah.
We could have a laksa food truck.
Yeah. We could make a fortune.
There we go. We're going to take a little musical break again on that note, and we will be right back.
You're listening to an Archived Mouthful show from September 28th, 2014, with John Ash as the guest. Again, this is an archived program from September 28th, 2014, Mouthful, with host Michelle Anna Jordan and guest John Ash. Listening to an archived Mouthful show from September 28th, 2014, with John Ash as the guest. Again, this is an archived program from September 28th, 2014, Mouthful, with host Michelle Anna Jordan and guest John Ash.
It's Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan, my guest, John Ash. It was always so much fun that I wish the show was at least 2 hours long. I got a note here.
Uh-oh.
Where is it? Here we go. Here we go.
Okay.
Steve Garner, who you do a show with and have for a really long time, he explained this once to me. I totally forgot about it, and it's in your book. You have to tell us West Coast folks what hot brown is.
Hot brown. It's the best turkey sandwich you'll ever have in your life. And it was something that was developed at the Brown Hotel, which is kind of an institution in Louisville, Kentucky, where
Steve is from.
That's Steve's home. And the hot brown is, you know, it's basically a turkey sandwich with gravy on top of it. But it's become kind of legendary in that part of the world. And it's especially legendary each year around Kentucky Derby time. So people go to the Brown Hotel and order hot browns and drink bourbon, you know, along with it.
Is there something particular that makes it special other than the hotel and Kentucky and bourbon?
No.
No? Okay.
Well, it's really good.
Okay. Yeah, okay, there's something else. There's the Philadelphia pot pie, which is another, not pot pie.
Soup. The pepper pot.
Pepper pot soup. That's something else. You've got a lot of little historical things,
which I find really interesting. So pepper pot soup. You know, and I think even Campbell's at one time had a pepper pot soup that they offered as part of their can line. And it's a kind of weird thing. And the story behind it is that Washington, you know, the George Washington, the father of our country, when they were doing battle with the British, this was before we won independence and all that stuff, were stuck in a cold winter on the other side of the Potomac River, and the troops were starving and all of that stuff. And so George Washington said to his cook, we have to get them something rejuvenating, something to warm them up and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, they didn't have very many ingredients around. And so the cook came up with this thing called, it was just outside of Philadelphia, so it's called Philadelphia Pepper Pot Soup. And so this is all supposedly a true story. He created this soup out of, the original one is created out of tripe. Tripe is the lining of the cow's belly. And, of course, you have to cook it forever, you know, to get it so that you can actually eat it, because it's very chewy and rubbery. It has a very distinctive aroma to it and all that kind of stuff that you either like or don't like. So he did this because he didn't have much. So some vegetables, the long simmered tripe, and lots of pepper.
Yeah, lots of black pepper.
Pepper, because pepper is a rejuvenator in all kinds of ways. You know, and it's it really does.
And it would cover up that taste of the tripe if you didn't like it.
Cover up the taste of the tripe and all that stuff. So the recipe that I included in the book is not the one with tripe, but the same idea with chicken that we did. And it's very peppery and it's really good and it's delicious. You know, it's kind of one of those things, especially as we're moving into fall and winter now. It's one of those kinds of things that come home and you smell the house smells
and pepper warms you up from the inside.
It's got all kinds of
dilates your blood vessels. It makes you hungry. That would be the only downside if you didn't have much to eat, but it also is very satisfying. Couple things you do in the book, not recipes, but you've got a couple of charts that I find really interesting. One is just about the requirements, and I'm not finding it. Here we go. The requirements for it's the
Whole Foods
Right. Chart animal welfare.
Thing.
I loved this.
Well, I included it not because I have anything to. I don't have anything to do with Whole Foods. Uh-huh. I mean, I. Uh-huh. So that's to be.
Yeah, and I actually didn't realize it was Whole Foods. I thought it was more one of the animal
completely
rights.
Completely transparent. But what it did was Whole Foods, if you're not aware, have taken a really important stand in their stores with all meat products. Mm-hmm. You know, whether two-legged or four-legged. That they buy, and it has this kind of five levels of, I don't know, ethical mm-hmm. concerns about animals. And in the case of birds, it's very, because I don't know how much we want to go into this, but in the case of chickens, you know, in conventional chicken operations, the beaks are cut off,
right.
You know, so they don't peck each other to death. They're, you know, there are all kinds of awful things that kind of go on there. And so Whole Foods took a stand, and this came out about a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And to me, it sort of said, this is how we should, for all of the protein products mm-hmm. that we have in America, this
is I think it's a really good guide.
It's a fantastic guide. And so it says that the animal must live and be dispatched on the place that it was born. Mm-hmm. So that means no more of these awful feedlots, especially when you think about beef and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I actually drove down this week to L.A. and was reminded again when I drive by
Harris
Ranch. And, you can smell it 40 miles on either side. And you see those poor animals out there. And it's like, that's no way to treat them. And, I don't know. That may sound like an hippy-dippy
I don't think it does at all.
Yeah.
And I think increasingly, you have a really big audience. And I think the bigger audience you have, the better it is for people to hear this. I think it's so important.
Well, and for both of us, because both of us have been talking about this for a long time. But one of the things, an organization that I actually helped found a number of years ago called the Chefs Collaborative,
right.
who are very vibrant and mm-hmm. alive now, kind of recognizing that chefs have the ability to kind of influence mm-hmm. beyond their restaurants and all that kind of stuff, for all these years, the 20 years that they've been in existence, but are even making a bigger pitch about it now. And isn't it interesting that finally Americans are beginning to listen to this? How many years has it taken us to sort of say, know where it's coming from, know how it's grown, know how it's processed, all of that stuff. And I guess it's that old adage that sometimes you have to say things repeatedly before it sinks in.
Yeah, it takes a while before it sinks in.
Yeah.
Along with that, and I meant to ask you this a little earlier, but it fits in here too, and it fits in with the whole thing of salmonella, but also ethical treatment, knowing where your food is from, and another section that you have where you do a taste test comparing boneless, skinless chicken breasts.
Yeah.
My first gun, I do want to get to that, but I also wonder, is it more ethical, environmentally responsible, better in many ways to buy an intact bird than a part of a bird?
I don't know whether there's an ethical consideration mm-hmm. there, but I think that there is a cost consideration.
Sure, there's certainly cost.
And one of the things is to learn how, in the case of a chicken or birds in general, mm-hmm. they're pretty easy to break down. You
have pictures.
Yeah, yeah. And once you do that, it's like, why would I ever go buy this? Because when you buy the parts, the mm-hmm. parts are more expensive by quite a lot often than buying the whole bird. And if you buy a whole bird, it's like when I go to the farmer's market and buy a good roaster, a mm-hmm. 4 or 5 pound chicken or something like that, and break it down myself. Well, that's, 2-3 meals out of that thing, because I can use the breast for one, the leg, thigh portions for something
and
else.
And then you can make soup.
And then make a really delicious stock mm-hmm. Out of the rest of it. And it turns out that even though you pay more for it in the farmer's market, it ends up being cheaper than what you'd buy at the supermarket because you've done it yourself. And it's also that knowing where it comes from. That one of the people, and I won't go too far off on this, but I teach over at the CIA, mm-hmm. the Culinary Institute of America, and one of the things I do with the young chefs there is to read to them parts of an essay written by Wendell Berry about 30 years ago mm-hmm. Called The Pleasures of Eating. And in there he talks about a number of things about how agriculture, how we're doing some evil things in agriculture and all that stuff. But he talks about what each of us can do. And one of the things that he talks about is to know the lifestyle and the and the makeup of everything that you eat. Mm-hmm. Be able to take it in its purest, most basic form and cut it up, chop it up, do whatever you're going to do with it.
Absolutely.
And deal with it then, because only then will you really appreciate what you have.
Yeah. And for some people, they really think that's an impractical luxury.
Yeah.
And I think if you're raising a family and you're working two jobs, I understand that. At the same time, we're in Sonoma County.
Yeah.
And there's almost nowhere in the world easier to do that than here. We have such an amazing abundance. It's like we have the responsibility to know our farmers here.
So, you know, one of the interesting things, I did this little survey, went online to look at the most popular classes in the Bay Area right now.
Uh-huh.
You know, you would think, it must be Italian cooking or it's butchering.
Oh, butchering is huge.
And here we're not, I mean, chicken's easy. It's a no brainer.
Yeah.
But it's like when you get into cutting up a pig or a cow or something like that, I mean, that's pretty serious stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, why do people want to do that? But I don't know. They do.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, that started about 3 years ago, I think. And it's like making your own salumi and charcuterie.
Yeah. Make your own bacon, which is so much better than what you buy on the market.
I made my own bacon back in, oh gosh, I forget if it was when I was writing Salt and Pepper or the BLT book, but I made my own bacon.
Yeah.
It was really good.
It is good.
I did not raise my own pig, though. No.
Well, that's next.
There we go. I got bacon from, or I got, you know, the sides from Nyman Ranch, the belly, when Bill Nyman still had it.
Yeah.
But it was good. I recommend doing it. I'm probably going to do it again.
Yeah.
So back to the part of the reason. Actually, I do want to get back to the chicken breast.
I know, I keep taking
off
topic.
But part of the reason I asked, not so much about ethical, but also from a health point of view, is I know that one of the problems with salmonella and E. coli in beef is that if you're going to Costco and buying a package of burgers, you know, that's been frozen and shipped, you know, 2,000 miles, you're getting meat from 1,000 animals or God knows how many.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if that process of commercially breaking down a chicken has any of those similar dangers.
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know whether I can answer that, but probably it does, because the beef analogy is a good one, because it's something like, and don't take this as gospel, but it's something like all of our beef now comes from 10 plants, 10 gigantic plants in America. And most of our chicken similarly comes from just a few producers, a few big producers. And so the chance for contamination and all of that stuff is great. So so the question is that I get is the pushback that I get about this is, well, but, you know, we have a expanding population. How are we going to feed all those people? People can't afford to, you know, what are you, some kind of food elitist and blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, no, not a food elitist, but it is just being sure of the source, and it doesn't have to cost you a lot of money. The other thing, and I know you've talked about this, is that we spend so little as a part of our budget on food in America compared to every other, you know, civilized nation in the world.
And
it's crazy.
And we also, compared to how most people around the world spend their time, we always talk about how busy we are, but we spend so little time cooking.
Yeah.
And so much time going to doctors, going to therapy, you know, figuring out if it's gluten intolerance that's making us depressed. You know, I sort of feel like, help your kid with homework, cook dinner, clean up, it's time for bed. You don't have to worry about so much.
Yeah.
You feel good.
And it doesn't have to be, you know, fancy schmancy cooking. I mean, there's so many delicious
dishes. Recipes just in this book.
Yeah, yeah.
You roast a chicken and you eat for 3 days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And turn it into a couple of meals.
Yeah.
You know,
so what are some of your favorite recipes in the book?
So one of the things, I actually did a class this week, and up at Relish up in Healdsburg, and they were a fun group. It was a hands-on class, and the two things, it blew my mind, the two things that drove them crazy, suddenly the room, you know, it's like, you know, people are enjoying it when everything goes quiet because they're jabbering and talking and all that stuff, were the Korean chicken wings, which are really stupidly simple to do. And the other was the chicken and shrimp meatball soup. So thinking about your upcoming book and all that kind of stuff. And those two things, people just, they just went nuts for them. And both of them are so simple.
Tell us about the wings.
The wings are... Very simple. What you do is take the wing, whack off the tip, you know, use that for stock. You don't have to. And how they do it in Korea is they make a little slurry just out of cornstarch and water, mm-hmm. put it in, then dip it in there, and then put it on a rack to let it kind of dry and to let the cornstarch adhere to it. And then they deep fry it, you know, until it's cooked through and very golden and pretty. And then make a sauce, and the basis for the sauce is this amazing ingredient, a chili paste called gujang. And gujang is, here in our Asian markets, you mm-hmm. can find it. You probably don't ever want to make it yourself because it's chilies and rice powder and some other things that are. But you buy it in a little tub, so you throw that in there along with soy sauce and ginger and green onions and kind of make a sauce out of it and cook it a little bit. So then when those chicken wings come out and they're hot, you toss it in the gujang based sauce. It's spicy and salty and sweet and all. It
sounds
just
really
drives you out of your mind. You know, I'm going to give it to Doug Keene to see if he's going to do it in the new Grayton, because he's doing a wings joint.
Oh, is he doing a wings joint?
That's his restaurant. Can you believe it? So here's this two Michelin star guy.
It's going to be a wings joint.
He's opening a wings joint at the casino.
He certainly should have those. Yeah. He's going to be the guest on Mouthful next week.
Oh, great. Oh, well, ask him about that.
I definitely will.
Tell him I got a recipe for him.
Okay. Oh, that's really interesting. This is not a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
Can you name the best chicken you've ever eaten?
Yes.
Oh, good. It is a fair question.
It is, you know, and sometimes history, you know,
things get
better, you know, over time. But the best, I think it was when I really understood what great chicken could be, and was in France. I did my initial study, culinary studies. Mm-hmm. I was a commis, a slave in France. and it was it's called the breast chicken, B-R-E-S-S-E, mm-hmm. the blue breasts, it's called. And it's distinguished by the fact that it has blue legs to mm-hmm. the chicken. They're kind of funny. And they're beautiful chickens with big combs, and mm-hmm. they're very, you know, they're kind of alpha chickens, you know, they take over everything. And the skin also has a blue cast to it. And just having that as a roast chicken was the best chicken I've ever had in my life.
Simple roast chicken?
Just a simple roast chicken, roasted in a cast iron pot, uh-huh. not just, you know, just in the oven. And that was at Moulin de Mujang. That was Roger Verger's place in the south uh-huh. of France. And it was the best chicken, without a doubt, that uh-huh. I've ever had. And they raise them. And there are a few, hopefully more will raise them in this country. It's a breed uh-huh. of chicken. They will raise them in this country. There are a few that are raising them now. The problem with them is, as opposed to regular chickens, is they're slow growers, you know, so you have to invest more in them to get them growing. But it's the Bleu de Bresse.
I have to
B-R-E-S-S-E.
Yeah. The best chicken I ever had was in what would be a diner here in Malaysia, somewhere north of Kuching on the island, in the state of Sarawak on the island of Borneo. All over there were restaurants called chicken rice, and all they served was chicken rice. And it was, you got a big scoop of rice, you got half a chicken, and you got a little bowl of garlic in coconut palm oil and ginger in a sweetened soy sauce. And that was it.
Yeah.
And a bowl of broth. Chicken broth. And
yeah.
you would pour it over the rice if you wanted to. And I think what was so good was this chicken was so fresh.
Yeah.
I think they were out back dispatching the chickens.
Well, but it was also a chicken that walked around and ate
bugs. A chicken that ran around. Yes, absolutely.
Ate rocks and
it was
did all
just
the things.
Yeah. so
yeah.
incredibly good.
I included in the book a variation on the theme.
I read that you had a Chinese called
Hainan,
right?
From Hainan. It's called Hainan chicken rice, and so
I was
all over
that, yeah.
Malaysia and all that, because the little street stalls sell this, and it's kind of the same. So it's rice, chicken broth, and then they have all kinds of condiments that you can get. But it's so simple, you know,
so simple and incredibly succulent. Where can people see you? I know you're doing something tomorrow, right?
Am I? Oh, I am. Thank you. God love you for You are so good. I am doing something tomorrow. I'm doing a book signing from four to six at my namesake place, John Ashton Company.
Barnes Road?
On Barnes Road, right on River and Barnes Road in there. And what's happened is that the restaurant has become, I don't spend very much time there anymore, but the restaurant's become, it has the most amazing happy hour time that goes on there.
Really?
It's one of the hot places to go.
Really?
If you want to meet somebody special and all that stuff, go there between 4 and 6, and it's because it's really beautiful. It's called the front room.
They have the best lampshades on the planet.
Well,
they're made out of vintage lingerie.
It's a happening spot. So we thought, well, we should do something at the restaurant, and I thought, well, rather than create a special event, maybe I'll just show up during happy hour from 4 to 6 and sign books. You know,
Can people buy a book there?
They can buy a book there, and also we'll be serving, God knows what they're going to do, but I let them just pick some things out of the book, which are complimentary, to try some bird thing, you know, to enjoy with a cocktail or a glass of wine or something.
What do you like to drink with chicken?
That's a good question. I don't know. Depends on
What else is with it.
Else is with it.
But sure.
Sort of, any good Sonoma County wine, I think, goes perfectly with chicken.
There you go. And on that note, we are just about out of time, John. So the publisher is Running Press, Culinary Birds, The Ultimate Poultry Cookbook. It is
$30.
$30. That's a bargain. Lots of beautiful color photographs. Lots of recipes, but really lots of, you can sit down and read this book, read all the educational material, and you can then cook any kind of poultry well.
And we tried to include history and all of that.
It's really interesting.
It was interesting. The introduction was written by Mike Leventini, who is the president of Petaluma Poultry in there. So it was great.
Congratulations. Yeah. Are we going to see another book?
Oh, I mean, you're so much better at turning out books than I am. It takes me a long time.
We spend a long time teaching, I'm a total introvert, so I can sit in my office and write. And on that note, we are out of time. Next week, it will be Douglas King for the whole hour. We will be talking about his new restaurant. We'll be talking about
Wings.
We'll be talking about Cyrus, which was one of the most delightful restaurants. And we're also going to talk about his really passionate commitment to rescuing dogs that people think are not rescuable. And you just got to love Douglas for that. He's doing a really, really great thing. So meet me back here next week for another episode of the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour Mouthful here on KRCB. Have a great week. Grapes are coming.